Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
Alex, you're here!
Hi!
I've missed you for so long.
Well, being sick does that.
I had to invite guests on so that I didn't feel so lonesome the last few times. They all send their best regards, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, yes. It worked.
It worked, and now you're all better. Do you feel like going on an adventure today?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, good news. Now that you're back and ready to go on an adventure, we get to talk a little bit about D&D Adventurers League on the show today. And who better to talk to than one of the resource managers for D&D Adventurers League, Alan Patrick. Alan, thank you for being on the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Yes, thank you so much for being on. AL is not necessarily a format that we're familiar with personally. We haven't been able to play in it, which is why we wanted to know a little bit more. But before we get into that, I was just wondering if we could just learn just a little bit about you, how you got involved with Adventurers League, you know, how you got drawn to the format, how you got introduced to it.
Okay. It is a tangled, weird path. It is a very convoluted road, but you know what? Mixed metaphors aside, I actually, like, as a kid, I wasn't allowed to get into any of these games, right? Like, it was the 80s were a very different culture. And I did some Dungeons & Dragons stuff with friends. Organized play was, at the time it was taking place, as they got into like the 90s, early 2000s, it was all at the convention level. So I didn't get a ton of experience and exposure to it. Finally saved my pennies and made it to Gen Con a couple of times, got friendly with some of the people that I saw there, right? It's an incredibly social circle. Eventually I was asked to consider writing a couple of ventures for 4th edition D&D. I wrote a dozen or so there. And as 5th edition was coming around, Wizards had said, hey, we're going to be talking to some people. We have this open application process. And long story short, I put in a resume. A few weeks later, they called and said, do you want this job? It doesn't pay well, but it's really super nerdy and cool. And we have a lot of hope for how it's going to grow. And here we are.
Yeah. So you were in it from pretty early on then.
From pre-day one, yes.
Pre-day one. Oh, okay. Excellent.
Very nice.
So now, did that start with 4th edition, or did that really start with 5th?
So my administration experience started with the 5th edition release. So the months or so prior was us setting up the program and such. For 4th edition, I didn't do any admin work, but I did write and contribute adventures and story concepts.
So Adventures League started in 4th edition, though?
Adventures League is a 5th edition product.
Only been in 5th edition. Okay, great. Now, 4th edition, was that the first time that you had played, or did you play earlier versions before you got introduced to them?
I had played a little bit before, as far as organized play stuff goes. In 3.5, there was an Eberron campaign called Zendark Expeditions that was available for stores and was encouraged for stores to use. So not as much focus on a convention play, more for stores and home, and that's what really got me.
Just in general, just wide swath. How does Adventures League work?
Wide swath?
Apparently. Nathan just wants like a basic, like, what's the deal with Adventure League, I guess?
What's the deal? Yeah.
So what's up with that? So Adventures League is the intention of it is to have a standardized set of expectations. And I don't want to say standardized experience because every DM, every player is going to interpret the content a little bit differently, right?
Sure.
And we want to provide the tools for DMs and players to really own the content. But by providing a standardized expectation, such as player's handbook plus one resource for your character creation and allowing or disallowing certain variant optional rules in the core rule books, flagging content as it's released from Wizards as being program eligible or not, or maybe it's program eligible notes. Mm-hmm. That way we can provide a common foundation from which players and DMs can build their interpreted experience. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, that does. That's actually a good jumping off point because I was kind of wondering how do you find out what is AL legal? What are criteria for determining Adventures League legal content?
On which side? Like the player side or on like the deciding factor for Adventure League side, Nathan?
Yes.
No, that's good. I think that is a totally valid question. And it's simpler than you might think.
Okay.
In a general sense, if it's published by Wizards of the Coast directly, it is almost certainly going to be in the program. If not fully, then in some major capacity. And by that, I want to call out an element from our current adventure, the Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus. It's a huge, sprawling adventure. The characters start in the, you know, the villainous city of Baldur's Gate. They end up going to Avernus, one of the layers of the Nine Hells. And in it, there are some really cool NPCs, but there are also some new and really cool items. Now, the book is produced by Wizards of the Coast. It's published by Wizards. It's written by the Wizards team. So we are going to do everything we can to support it. I mean, technically, we're all Wizards team members, too. So it's just a good idea, right? but let's, you know, calling out one of the items in specific is the Shield of the Hidden Lord. Without giving too many spoilers, it is a legendary item, meaning it's very, very powerful. It's got its own presence in the story and is just it can be disruptive. Because of how early it's available and all the powers that it's got, we've decided to not make a blanket approval for the item, but we've nominated it to be what we call a story item. So when your characters are playing through that story, if they've already earned that item, anytime they go into Descent into Avernus adventure, they'll have access to it. Now, if you pull your character out and you go play something from like Tomb of Annihilation or Tyranny of Dragons, which we just recently reviewed, the story item from Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus does not travel with them. It's waiting for them when they get back. So that's one of those modified availability things.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it doesn't really translate over to the other adventure.
Correct.
But you did get there.
It's central to the story. It's necessary for the story of Descent into Avernus, but it has no presence in the other one. And if we were to allow it mechanically, it would just become an unbalancing element.
So we could call that like a quest item almost, if you were using like a video game terminology for it too.
Yes. Yep. Quest item, story item. It's all the same language. Absolutely.
From a personal standpoint, what do you actually like about the format of Adventures League?
Man, portability, to be honest with you. We have a huge, huge catalog of adventures. And I do a lot of time with convention support. I travel to a lot of regional shows. And I, along with Claire Hoffman, the other resource manager, we support events all over the world. So getting people the adventures they want and the stuff that's compelling for them and for their audience is something that I really enjoy. You know, not everyone wants to play the new hot thing. Sometimes they really want to live in Chult, right? In Tomb of Annihilation, and that storyline as a DM, that's something they're really excited about. So how can I best facilitate them and their events and encourage them to continue to grow, even though it's content that a lot of people have already played, if their player base is still growing and it's largely due to their passion regarding that story element, I want to support that. And that's a big part of what makes me happy with it.
Now, I guess the thing that I'm really interested in is, like, coming from the point of view of playing, like, a home game, the homebrew content, playing on your own, what it's like for somebody who's coming in from there. If I'm only used to home games, what are some of the big differences that I'm going to notice immediately in Adventures League?
I think the biggest thing the players find is character creation for Adventures League stuff. We use a method called PHB plus one. So that means that the player's handbook is available, and when you create your character, you can take one additional approved resource. So that might be Xanathar's Guide. It might be something from Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. If it includes those mechanical elements for a certain race that you want to use or a certain class or archetype or something, that becomes your plus one. And as you continue to level up after that, those are the only resources that you can pull your options from.
I see.
So that doesn't impact your ability to like use magic items because those are found elsewhere and those are awarded to you by the DM. But when you gain a new level, you choose your new options from your pre-selected resources.
Now, is that based on each character having that PHB plus one of their choice, or is it the entire game is PHB plus one collective choice?
Every player can select their own plus one resource per character.
Okay. Because that makes a big difference if everyone's...
Yes.
I mean, everyone can pull from different things then, which is really cool because you can build your character the way you want, which is nice. But I think that is really cool because it simplifies it down from, like what we used to do in 3.5 when I played, which was go, cool, so I want, oh, where's that feat? Which one of these 400 splat books here has this feat and has this item that I want to take?
Yeah, I recently found the sorcerer that I played a ton in 3.5. And I looked at it and like the list of feats, the list of spells. I'm like, I don't even know what books these came. I remember I had a truck at the time, and I kind of needed the truck to move my character and its books around.
Yeah. I think that like from the outsider's point of view, which is usually what I have, that was always really terrifying. Because I'd see the size of the books, and I'd be like, how many of these do I have to lug?
Right, and and that's something that we want to be very mindful of. One of the long-running concerns about just Dungeons & Dragons in general was that players, some in DM, sometimes felt like they had to know all the things from all the books, and oh god, there's so many. And that's not the case, especially with Adventurers League. Like, you slim it down to PHB plus one, and you have these encapsulated adventure experiences. The lore is there for the DM. They don't have to read too much outside of it. Everything like adventure background and lore and all that stuff is easily available. Sure. So that you can all sit down, share an experience at the table, and then go about your lives, right? Until you meet again and play your next game. We didn't want people to feel like they had to own 40 books or memorize these 18 books or whatever the previous editions might have given them the impression of.
Okay. Now, if I have a new character, I'm completely fresh, I don't know what I'm doing, I sit down at a table, are people going to explain what's going on to me, or do I just kind of assume that I'm on the adventure, I'm going?
There's a certain assumption as you sit down. Like, there are adventure seeds and adventure hooks, story hooks that are given in the beginning, so the DM can kind of weave all those together. Sure. But it kind of comes down to your group and your own play style. Like, I know when I run my group at home, most of my players, they just buy into the shared collective reasoning of, well, this is our adventure day, so I'm just going to do it. Yeah. And other players sometimes might need to be convinced. Like, they may communicate with their DM and say, like, this is my character, this is my character's background, this is where they're from. How do I get involved in this current adventure?
Right.
So by combining the tools on the character sheet with the tools that are in the opening of the adventure, the story hooks and such, we should have everything we need to kind of bind all that together pretty efficiently.
I wanted to ask a little bit about those on the fly character choices, because because I play a game. I guess my additional resource would be a turtle package, because I'm a turtle. That would be mine. But he has a tendency to get into a whole bunch of trouble and make decisions that are probably not great. When a character kind of goes off book because they're role playing, how does that get handled at the table?
Well, that is a very common question, right? Like, some players and DMs really want to have that like strictly dictated. Yeah. And my response to it is, you've got to talk to your DM. Some DMs are not comfortable with going outside the book, like going off the rails. It's just not something they're comfortable with. Some players aren't comfortable being in a heavy role play group. Mm-hmm. Some players aren't comfortable being told, like, hey, I can't role play my character this way. Like, how do we meet in the middle on that? And the biggest advice I have is always at the beginning of your session, especially when you're doing like convention games or you're meeting a group for the first time, talk to your DM and talk to your other players. A quick 90-second heads up of like, hey, this is my character name. I play a turtle. I find myself in a lot of trouble because sometimes I make rash decisions, or if something is green, I always go for the color green, no matter if it's good for me or not. I just love it so much. Whatever your motivation happens to be, if you communicate that in sort of like an out of character concept or a context right at the beginning, it can help set that tone for the rest of the game.
I see. Okay.
But it's got to be communication. You really got to just take a few seconds, talk to the other people at the table, because we want to share a positive experience.
Buy-in is one of those things that is sometimes difficult for certain players, and I've definitely run across those groups that have run either like super combat heavy or super role playing heavy, or a little bit of a mix, which is, it's always interesting with different groups and different playstyles, DMs and players, because getting the right type of buy-in, whereas I've personally, as a DM, I've never ever enjoyed the trope of, oh, you meet in the tavern to get your quest. The last time I did that, I had them meet in a tavern and summarily set the tavern on fire on them.
always
beautiful. I love it.
That's every tavern experience, though.
Yeah, but like it's that buy-in that is really important right at the beginning. It's like, why are the characters here? Why, you know, if they want to just do the whole, oh, we already know each other, and that to me the hardest thing is getting a group of characters and figure out why they know each other, how'd they get there, or are they just meeting? That's the worst for me, is when I'm like, oh, you're all just meeting for the first time, and the characters like, oh, we don't like each other. I'm like, well crap.
To that end, when I run my tables, and if I've got time at a convention, I try and do this too, I'll take a look at everybody that's sitting around me, and, you know, as a DM, I just say, hey, what's your character name? Give me your background, and what are like two key moments from your adventuring career? Two big awesome things, even at level one, like what incited you to become an adventurer? Like, what did you see? What did you experience? By the time we get through all of the players at the table, they can begin forming those relationships. And it's really cool to watch it just kind of organically happen, because you may have like a halfling sitting on your left and a bugbear sitting on your right. And if you take them separately, you know, like a halfling and a bugbear, they would probably never interact. But, you know, the halfling might say like, well, I was a master chef. I was a master baker. And then, you know, they get around the table and the bugbear's like, I'm a competitive eater. Of course I know this chef. So they might be from different islands, right? They might be from different worlds entirely. Yeah. But by sharing some of your character info, your players, by way of their characters, can begin forming those associations. And they build that reality for you. It's an easy tool that took me a long time to really understand. But, oh, man, it's so good.
I usually end up doing a lot of role playing for my character, and I worry that like I would sit down at the table and then there'd be a bunch of people who are definitely into the crunch, and I'd be like, oh no, I am in trouble now. Do you see that a lot, where there might be just like one or two people at the table that really just have a specific way of playing, and they have to figure out how to motivate? Okay.
Yeah, my wife is, she plays a lot. She is very combat focused. Like, she doesn't really do a whole lot of the role play stuff. She has to be with a trusted group of friends to really relax and do it, because she wants to do it really, really well. And she can already do combat really, really well.
Sure.
But then, you know, I've got some other players that maybe they're just joining us for a one-time game or something that, you know, they're completely focused on the role play. So it does become a bit of a juggle, where I want to give everyone a little bit of time to shine. Everyone should have a moment to really, you know, to be a big damn hero, pardon the expression there, to be a big hero at the table.
Right.
You know, so as a DM, you kind of got to be mindful of the cues that people are giving you so that you can give everyone a chance to really show off and be that hero, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm getting the feeling that, like, your wife you've seen in home games and also in Adventures League. But if you've seen players like that, do you find that there's more of a focus on crunch in Adventures League than in a home game? Or does it really just depend on the person in the group?
I think the question of perception really is, as weird as that might sound, if you look at, like, some of the online communities, Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, you see a lot of questions about, how does this mechanical thing work? How does this mechanical thing work? How do I get a plus 35 on my attack? You know, whatever they're going
for.
But when you get to the table, in my own experience, the majority of my tables have been more focused on interacting with the story element than defeating the mechanical element. Sure, we all love to roll dice. I mean, that's why once you've been a tabletop gamer for a while, you may find that you have, 40 sets. Just saying.
Maybe. Possibly. You know,
it's a starter collection. What can
40,
I say?
50. Yeah, whatever. it's the starter pack.
Right.
Sure.
But once we get to the table, I find that my players, regardless of where I've gone, you know, around the world to run some of these games, they focus more on the thematic elements and the narrative elements than just getting to the next fight. You know, and there are going to be some players who just want to go combat.
Yeah.
But those are not as commonplace as you might think, and as commonplace as what the online communities might make it seem. So
that was my impression, that it was more combat focused.
I definitely think older editions of D&D were a lot more combat oriented. 3.5 specifically was very combat heavy.
Well, and to be fair, even some of our earlier seasons were more focused on that. And, you know, that was because at the time our direction, and even if you read like the 5th Ed Player's Handbook and the DMG, it doesn't really spend a whole lot of time talking about like ad hoc experience rewards and roleplay experience rewards. It pretty much says like, hey, experience comes from defeating challenges, and those challenges are in those books defined as defeating creatures, right?
Okay.
Disarming a trap doesn't necessarily, as per the Dungeon Master's Guide, doesn't necessarily grant experience, but defeating a dragon does. But as our program has grown and we've seen our player shift, we want to embrace that. So we've adjusted the way we're developing our content and the way we're working with our authors to promote that viewpoint to where, you know, people are getting rewarded for the time they're investing in the storyline and in the story objectives rather than the time they're investing in defeating creature X and Y.
That's actually something I think Nathan and I have talked about several yes. occasions is experience mm-hmm. role-playing. It's a lot harder to agitate the EXP gain from role-play because role-playing itself doesn't necessarily have a challenge rating like a monster does. So it's like, and I think we talked about something else, like if menial tasks gave XP, then you could just grind those out and just, oh, I'm level 20, what'd you do? Oh, well, I spent 8 hours baking.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird things that the non-combat stuff is a lot harder to judge the amount of XP that you get for it, which is, I think, one of those reasons that online, especially, you see people turning to, say, milestone type of XP gain or level gain and stuff like that. Is just, it's a different way to gain XP that rewards overall achievement in the story or the game or the character growth, which is really interesting.
Really, we want people to play the game in the manner that they enjoy, right? We don't want to prescribe a certain method of play. We don't want to say, like, you're only going to level if you fight this big thing, because super creative players may decide, like, hey, instead of going to fight that big Dracolich, what if we just collapse the cavern on top of it and then throw a bunch of fireballs at it? Like, we're not actually fighting it, but will they defeat it? Well, probably.
Yeah.
So, you know, they should be rewarded for the time that they invested, the resources they invested, you know, spell slots and, you know, explosives and whatever else. We want people to play the game that they want to play. We want them to do that while still interacting with the story elements that we've given them. And ultimately, much like working in the IT industry, right? As long as you get to the right resolution, you get to the right end point, does it really matter how you get there?
Yeah. You know, the thing that if I understand AL and the general format is I could move my character's progression from one table to another.
Yeah.
Like if okay.
Yeah. So,
how does that work? Yeah, I'm trying to just kind of wrap my head around that. Like,
so let's say you play a couple of groups or a couple of games with your local group, right?
Okay.
And then you've got this opportunity to go to Winter Fantasy with us in February. It's scenic Fort Wayne. It's snowy. Why not? You know, it seems like a destination event.
Perfect.
So you can take your character from your home Adventurers League group, your local group. You grab your character sheet. You grab your log sheets. Maybe grab a couple of dice. You get on a plane. You come to Fort Wayne and you sit down. Because you've used the same creation, you've used the same adventure content, you can very easily and efficiently jump right in. You don't have to spend a whole lot of time describing to a DM like how you got certain item or how you got access to this race that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah.
You're all using the same foundational elements. So okay. It's plug and play. You plug yourself in a seat, you play the game.
Perfect. Now, I'm trying to figure out from a player's perspective, that's where I'm coming from. But if you know, you've run games, a few. For you, is it difficult to run an AL game as opposed to a home game, or is it just a different experience?
For me, and like you said, I've run a few games. For me, the biggest hurdle is just encapsulating my experience to like a 4-hour slot, right?
Sure.
As a DM, I really love to explore background elements, and I want to encourage and empower my players to explore those elements as well, which sometimes means that my games may go a lot longer. I wrote a horror-themed game several years ago, just this thing trapped under the ice, the players get to interact with it. Yes. And like, it's intended for a 4 to 5 hour slot, but I rented it for a group in Buffalo at one of their shows. I think we ran like 16 hours because they just weren't done. But they weren't. They knew they weren't getting extra experience. They weren't getting extra gold. They just weren't ready to move on. There's like, there's so much here. And you keep embellishing. How far can we go? I'm like, will you tell me we're done? And he stopped feeding me drinks.
How does a 16-hour session work?
A 16-hour session is we cancel a whole lot of plans, and we moved from the game hall to the hotel bar. And then when that closed, they just let us sit there because we were apparently too nerdy to interact with. So
so we were going to tell you to leave, but we're like, oh, they're a little bit too nerdy.
Just yelling at each other and throwing dice. Oh, God, what do we do?
We can't do anything about it. Just let it go. Let it go.
Just let it go. They're in the corner already. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was under the impression, like, usually if you're looking at Adventures League games, they're relatively short by comparison to what I would normally play in a home game, right? They're like a few hours.
So we design a lot of our content around the 4-hour benchmark. We find that four hours is pretty standard. And honestly, that's been the organized play like benchmark for decades now.
Okay.
Some of our games we do produce for 2-hour content with some optional bonus stuff tacked on so you can expand the game. We've produced them as long as 8 hours with bonus content before. But really, like, that's been a key bit of feedback from our players and DMs over the years. And starting with this current season, season 9, we give the suggested run times. And if players run longer, run shorter, like if that's the game they want to play, here you go. We've assigned reward models so that a DM can give more or less based on time invested. And it's as long as it's spent in pursuit of the story objective, we're going to trust the DM to make the right call there.
Oh, okay. So it still does in some ways come down to story and character development and all those things. You want to still get all those things in.
Yeah. And every group's going to run a little bit differently. You know, if a group completes the entire adventure because they have an awesome build and they've got synergy, right? And they complete a 4-hour adventure in 2.5 hours. Oh, okay. Like they should. They should get the rewards. Absolutely. Yeah.
But there's no real timer that's like, okay, at the 4-hour mark, we are done and deal with it.
Those are rare. They may pop up a few times in certain adventures. We do have some adventures that are explicitly timed, but those are broadcast up front. We generally refer to those as our competitives or our epic adventures. And those time bound expectations, like it's very explicitly spelled out in the adventure. Like the players have 1 hour to do this objective.
Right. Okay.
So, and those are crazy.
You have an hour to complete the Tomb of Horrors. Go.
Wow.
So here's my character sheet and my dice. Have a day.
Yeah. Sure. That sounds fun. Boy, yeah, that feels like a marathon run. I didn't plan on doing in a game.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly. When you have things like that, are there ways that like Adventures League is able to streamline the process in order to keep things moving faster than I normally would?
Yeah. Yeah. So over the last couple of seasons, we've begun including some more visual aids, you know, adventure flowcharts and stuff, especially for our epics and competitive. Like we have to have those visual reminders and annotated breakdowns. Like, hey, at the hour 15 mark, the event organizer does this. The 2-hour mark, the event organizer does this. Sure. For standard adventures, we try not to lock it to timeliness. We may put some suggested durations on there just to kind of give a DM an idea of like how long a section should take. But for standard adventures, it's by no means a hard requirement.
Sure. But you can kind of get an idea that like, okay, this is supposed to take like half hour to get through this one section. And I know I'm going longer than that. Okay, I might have to try to reel this in so that we can
either reel the players in or maybe just cut the next experience a little bit short. Like, you know, if it's a role play encounter and they, you know, it says it's assumed to take 30 minutes, but they took an hour. Maybe it's because they enjoyed it. In that next encounter, if it's combat, maybe consider trimming some hit points or giving the characters some extra advantage. Grant them inspiration going in so that they can be big heroes and, you know, still get the same experience, just maybe not have all the exact same roadmap.
Right. And that must help with pacing, too.
Yeah.
So
that
it doesn't slow down too much. Okay, excellent.
Yep.
Now, I'm used to like playing where everybody levels up at the same time. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated with people being able to move their character between different tables. Mm-hmm. Is it tricky if you have a party that has like a high level character and a low level character at the same time?
It can be, for sure. And that, okay. That really comes down to the skill of the DM, and really comes back to what I mentioned earlier. Like you got to talk to your players. You got to talk to your DM. Who are you? Like, what's your experience? What are some cool things that you've done? For our hardcover adventures, like you may run into those big level gaps. You know, someone's sure. level 8, someone's level 2. For our organized play adventures, for the PDF stuff that we put up through like DM's Guild, we actually write those for specific tiers. So there may still be a gap, but it won't be as large. Like tier 1 is level 1 to 4. Tier okay. 2 is level 5 to 10. So, you know, yeah, there's a power difference at level 5 okay. and a power difference at level 10. But it's not like putting a 2 and a 10 or a 2 and a 14 together.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was wondering, like, if you can have those scenarios. But I would yeah. probably not want to be the level 2 in that scenario anyway.
it's an experience, to say the least.
Yeah, I would think so, because it's going to have to be somewhat challenging for a 14, but yeah. it's going to be interesting for me. Say I'm interested in getting into Adventures League, either running or playing. Is there mm-hmm. a process? Is there anything that I have to sign up for in order to become part of Adventures League or
no,
join it?
Adventures League joining is you grab the documentation. We currently have the newest docs on DM's Guild. You can find the quick link to it on the banner on our site, which is dndadventuresleague.org. Okay. It's the player and DM pack. There should be a bunch of links that take you right there. So the only thing to really sign up for would be like a DM's Guild account. Is because when we release new versions of that documentation, we put it in the same location.
Okay.
So season after season, you don't have a bunch of different download links to manage. You just download the newest version from that same space.
Okay. Okay.
It's free document. Like there's nothing else to it.
Okay.
We're looking at some different distribution methods. Nothing I'm quite ready to talk about, but we've got some exciting stuff planned there.
Oh, okay.
But there's no like central tracking. In the old days, you had to have like a DCI number and such. DCI is completely separated.
Yeah, I remember that from my old days of playing Magic: The Gathering.
It sounds like you've escaped and are in the recovery steps.
I went from Magic the Gathering to Warhammer 40K, so I don't really know.
There's a transition.
It was a transition. But this was, I stopped playing right after Mirrodin Block, so.
Okay. I played a little bit after that. I was competitive. I was competitive Magic until shortly after that. And then I picked up like Hordes and War Machine and some more D&D stuff. So yeah. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. I only played like drafting once or twice, but mostly I just played on my own. I didn't really play in competitively when it came to Magic. But I do have boxes of cards sitting around, so there's
one
something.
One of us.
Google gobble. But like, say I wanted to actually run a game in AL, a council doesn't come to my door and say, you will now go through the building process, okay?
No, there's, I know some older editions had some like DM certification stuff and DM ranking. We are not that formal. We want people to play the game and relax, enjoy it, and just have a great time with your friends.
Sure.
We're providing the basic documentation. Outside of that, it's your game. It's your world. Build it and do it as you see fit.
Sure. I'm not necessarily with my friends, though, in an AL format, right? I might sit down with a complete mm-hmm. group of strangers, and hopefully they'll be my friends by the end, but maybe
for 4 hours at a time, they're friends. Yeah.
for short periods of time. Doesn't have to be outside of that, obviously. So some of the new stuff that's been coming out for Adventures League, one of the big things I've been hearing about is seasonality. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. Seasonality is a topic that we started exploring earlier this year. It has changed quite a bit. So initially, we had talked about seasonality being like, once you create a character for season 9, like it's only season 9 going forward. It won't be able to play older stuff. We listened to a lot of fan reaction, players, DMs. They gave a lot of both positives and negatives for that. And we ultimately decided to not go with it. Now, that said, we did managed to include some of the seasonality elements in our current organized play format, sure. meaning that like the character rewards and DM rewards rather are pretty much optimized for running season 9 content. You still get stuff for playing your other games, but running the current storyline is going to net you some bigger buy-in, some of the tastier rewards. Maybe those are just animal companions or an infernal war machine or what have you. DMs that run that content are going to have access to more of those rewards for their own characters more easily.
Okay. Yeah, I want all the pets. If there are pets available, I will take those.
Pokemon's a thing for a reason, man.
Yeah, exactly. And I can make my pets fight each other. That's always fun. I think that's probably more lethal in D&D than Pokemon. But
we do have a Tressum named Slobberchops, and I love him.
Oh, perfect. Excellent. Do I have to choose a season for my character?
So when you create your character, you can assign to the current season if you're just doing hyper relaxed casual stuff at home.
Okay.
Basically, it's a you do you sort of moment, right?
Okay.
But we have some additional benefits if you choose to play, say, like a tiefling as a it's part of the season 9 storyline. You assign to that season and you get a couple of extra benefits. Like it unlocks a couple of extra tiefling powers and wings and all sorts of things.
Oh, okay. Excellent. From a cosmetic standpoint too, I did want to mention this because I have my character. My character is a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Because of that, I did go outside of some of the cosmetic elements to build my character than they actually list in the book, because he's a mutant, so he needs to be 7'2" and he needs to be 1,000 pounds, and he needs to glow green. But now technically, you know, that's outside of the realm of the character creation for a turtle, but would they kind of let that slide since it's only cosmetic if I was in Adventure League, or would they reel that back in?
Like all the DMs that I've talked to and in my own experience seeing people at public spaces.
Sure.
If a player sits down and they've invested that kind of time and creativity, they're going to let it ride.
Again,
you know, like talk to your DMs up front because they might be like, well, 7'2", well, today's adventure, like it's going to be a little more confined than that. You have to get 6 feet for this. Is that cool? You know, that sort of thing. But
sure.
Like cosmetic changes, that's something that our players do quite regularly. You know, they might say like in your case, you're a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, right?
Right.
You've got a long sword. Mechanically, it's a long sword. But for you, you might call it a katana. Katanas don't exist in any of the rule books.
I gotcha.
But if you're just like, I have a long sword, I'm using the stats of a long sword, it can be used one or two-handed because it's versatile. So can a katana, I call it a katana, but it is just a long sword mechanically. Like flavor changes like that, as long as it doesn't change the mechanics, do it up, go nuts.
I don't have a katana so much as I have a scimitar, but I can tell you right now that I don't think the scimitar would be AL legal. It feels too powerful for a regular scimitar. it does like 1d6 plus 4, and it's plus 1 to hit. And I'm like level 7. So,
well, I mean, what that sounds like is mechanically, it sounds like you have a scimitar, right?
Yeah.
You've got a strength of what, 18?
Oh, I have a strength of 20. I'm a punch turtle.
Okay. So
yeah, that's where your plus 4 is coming from, Nathan.
Yeah, so actually good news is it'd be a plus 5, exactly. And then if it's a plus 1 on top of that, you know, because it's a plus 1 weapon, it's a scimitar plus 1 plus your 5, so you're actually doing 6 bonus damage on a hit.
Actually, the scimitar itself does plus 4, and then I do plus 5, so I end up with a plus 9. you see where I'm coming
from? Maybe we should talk.
Generally you don't get plus 4 weapons, Nathan. Gotta talk to Dom.
Hey, you know what? I'm sorry. I killed a Gith Yankee. He had 2 scimitars. I had 2! And then I realized I'm a monk, so it really doesn't mean anything for me to have an option.
isn't that a really, really pretty silver Gith Yankee scimitar, Nathan?
Ooh.
It is not cursed. I identified it. He said it's not cursed.
That's a very specific terminology right there. Not cursed.
It is. It sounds like something I would have written.
Yeah,
this sounds like something I wrote, was it?
Nothing involving the scimitar has happened to me.
I mean,
all the other things that happened to me that were negative had nothing to do with the scimitar.
I just refuse to tell you anything about Githyanki. That's all, Nathan.
That's perfectly fine. It's probably because, for the best.
I mean, if Dawn is using that sword that I think it is, then have fun with that.
It does good damage.
I think you would agree that that sword coming from the Githyanki is more fun than anything else I could hear. I think Alan would agree with me. I assume he knows more about Githyanki than you do, Nathan.
It's guaranteed. You know more about Githyanki.
The Gith are really cool, but I've kind of been playing in the Kaius, the worm god space here for a couple years. So, I mean, if we want to talk about worms and undead, I'm your guy.
Yes, yeah. So just an elevator. If you were to give an elevator pitch to somebody who's like, I like my home games, I like the freeformness of it. If you were to give an elevator pitch to them to say, hey, you should try out Adventurers League, what would you tell them?
Imagine taking your home game and connecting it with a shared population of 130,000 other players, right? Sharing that game, being able to, wherever you travel, go to the local game store, go to a local convention, sit down with your character sheet and continue to progress with that same character that you know and love for as long as the game goes on.
Oh, yeah, that's a good pitch. We didn't even hit floor 3, and I'm already we haven't even hit the penthouse. That's good. I definitely would like to have that kind of experience. I also kind of like the idea, too, that like when it can be very difficult getting a group together on a regular basis, but being able to, you know, meet with a group that's able to, even though I don't know them personally, does feel nice because I know that I can do that on those nights. And then the portability, like you were talking before. You said that you've run a lot of games. How many games do you estimate you actually have run in Adventurers League?
This year or through the life of the program?
Yes.
So I've got a little one at home. So this year has been, it's been a lot more casual. I haven't done nearly as much travel, but I'd say I'm still pushing about 200 games this year.
Okay. Yeah.
my busy year is when we launched our author only program. And that's where I started getting into like the Kaius and Worm God stuff. I think that was my busiest one, and I ran about 800 tables that year.
Oh boy!
Oh,
that's multiple games every day of the year.
Yeah. So like when I would travel or go to a convention, I'd run 12 to 14 slots. It's a time I didn't have a kid. My wife and I were, you know, we were text communicating while we were states apart. So like I'd run 3, sometimes 4 games a day, just so people could kind of get in and see the cool new stuff. But that was my high end. I'd say I usually average 250 to 300.
Okay.
Where can I get in on this so that I can quit my job and play games and make probably about the same amount, probably more than I'm making now, actually.
If you love ramen and you hate sleep, you too can do it.
Good news, I don't sleep and I do buy ramen at work. I get those 36 cent ramen noodles that we sell.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Throw it in there with some celery, carrots, and chicken breast, you got yourself a heck of a soup.
That's a meal.
Yes.
That's ramen that eats like a meal right there.
Nathan, we need to start producing 300 to 400 or 800 episodes of our podcast a year.
There's only so much I could do, Alex. There's only so much I could do. I would if I could, and if it was feasible, I would do it. But
it's feasible. They're just going to be all live streams.
They're all just live streams now. We're just live stream 24 hours a day. There you go.
No pressure. No pressure.
No pressure.
Also, no money, so it's fine.
But you know what? It's just worth it to see me, what I look like after like 70 straight hours on air. It's worth it for that. Is there anything coming to Adventurers League in the near future that you can tell me about
that you want people to know about, rather?
I'm trying to think about how best to phrase this, because I just had a chat with the boss, and there was a lot of real cool stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
Some things that I can share without getting too far in the weeds here. Internally, we've been talking about our author-only content. We do have some of the admins looking to release some of their older adventures in the next 4 or so months. So things that we have written previously and haven't been able to publish, you know, for time or licensing or what have you. We're getting to a point where we can put those out. So those are outside of our normal storylines, but they get into some really cool situations and environments. keep an eye on some of the vendors that we've recently added, not explicitly Adventures League, but if you're familiar with like Beetle and Grimm, do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes, I think I do. Yes.
Yeah. So they do the premium boxes. We actually have some Adventures League rewards inside the new box. I actually got to design that stuff. So there's some really cool stuff there. And the future looks really bright. The biggest thing I can say, though, is if you have an opportunity to go to a local convention, do it. Yeah. We've got a lot of cool stuff on the fairly near horizon for public play. So even if you can't make it to like Gen Con or Game Hole Con, go to some of the local events that are near. And if you're, you know, for people who are listening and are in the US, like we've got events all over the place. If you hit our site, dndadventuresleague.org/conmap, CONMAP, you can actually see all of the events globally that people have registered on the site. We've got so much cool stuff coming for the public side of things.
Nice.
Storyline wise and just little like player trinket wise, all sorts of cool stuff.
Nice. Now when you say older adventures, we're not going like way far back, like Temple of Elemental Evil kind of thing. It's more recent than that.
Right. It's all from the advent of the 5th edition rule set and Adventures League author only program. These are adventures that only the authors can run. And so far the approved authors have been Wizards of the Coast employees and D&D Adventures League administrators. So, we may like run custom content that is only something that I can run or only something that Travis Woodall can run or something like we've had Mike Morales run some custom stuff and Perkins.
Nice.
Some of those adventures are circling back around and we're looking at actually publishing a few more of those. I think we've got like 40 or so in that basket. But of those 40, so far, only like 8 of them have been published, and there's another batch of 8 or so coming up here quick.
Like, when you're looking at stuff that's coming through Unearthed Arcana, like, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, yes, I want to be an Arcanist, yes, I want turrets. Do you ever see those kinds of things coming to a format like Adventures League?
Yes and no. So, if they become eligible for Adventures League play, they won't be specifically in that format. Like, you look at Unearthed Arcana as like playtest material, basically. Like, it's seen some internal playtesting, now it's ready for the public to check out. If it gets fully approved, you may find that it's in a future source book with additional revisions and playtest feedback applied.
Okay.
And that is where we get into like the PHP plus one stuff, like that's how people would select it.
Right.
Like going back, you know, like early on, one of the first Unearthed Arcana add-ons was the Artificer.
Yeah.
And we got Eberron coming. Like the book will be out, I think it's next week. So
everyone wants to be a Warforged Artificer.
Yeah,
absolutely. Or a Warforged Druid, because if I see another person at my table named Optimus Primal, I will give them inspiration.
Oh man. Make me a promise that you only ever give them inspiration if they wild shape into a gorilla.
Well, they have to scream roll out, but yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking I'm thinking Transformers Beast Wars.
Yes. Absolutely.
So he was the gorilla in that. So
yep.
You don't have to tell me, I know.
We're aware.
His nickname can be Maximal.
Yeah.
Because they weren't the Autobots in Beast Wars.
That's true.
They were the Maximals and Predacons.
Somebody watched the whole series.
Terrible, terrible CGI.
It was really Holy bad crap. CGI, but you know what? It's so endearing, you can't help it.
Exactly.
And the one last thing I have to ask is something that you were mentioning earlier. How do I get a plus 35 on attack?
You don't, Nathan. That's not statistically possible with a rule set.
Well, you might be able to, because Wish is a really powerful spell, and it does have a clause for doing things that aren't necessarily in the text. So talk to your DM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Aside from like a Wish spell.
Aside from that.
You should not be getting that big.
Maybe a field trip to Seattle and try and get into the wizard's office and have a meeting with Merles and Perkins.
Yeah. Can I just get this limited time item that's only available like in one season or one campaign? And it just happens to be a 35.
I mean, if I had a meeting with Perkins and Merles, I'd be like, listen, guys, time travel.
Sure, why not? This sounds like great fun.
I don't know. I don't see time travel happen very often in campaign settings. So I mean,
I'm just saying we got we had a chunk of season 8 that dealt with it.
You might be surprised. See, I missed that. Okay.
So hey, you know they actually did address it, Alex. So
Waterdeep, Bellport, vampires, beholders, and a little time travel mixed in. Because why not?
You introduce time travel, it just gets better.
It's fun when you do it really interestingly, though. So. I guess I missed that.
You do have to, it does have to be interesting. That's kind of like a rule of time travel.
Yeah.
Time travel can be really mundane, Nathan.
Like going to the future.
I'm going to the future right now.
Yeah, you are going into the future right now. It's called time. It's
I'm traveling in time, Nathan.
Traveling outside of the normal time. The time travel we're doing right now is fairly mundane, but you know what? The nice thing is that it has not felt nearly as mundane because Alan Patrick has been with us. And that is terrific. Alan, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show giving us a lot more information about Adventures League. If people wanted to find out more information about Adventures League somewhere on the internets, where would you suggest they go for more info?
You can check out our site, dndadventuresleague.org, or hit us up on Twitter, @ADV_league. Just ping us and say, hey, I want to learn more. And we are happy to fire back a whole bunch of links and get you references. If you tell us where you're at and if you're looking for a game, we might even know a couple of people.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Now, can they find you specifically?
Yeah, I have a goofy Twitter handle called Warftiner, WARFTEINER. It is a complete garbage word that means nothing on its own, like a lot of the things that I write.
Yeah, well, that's okay, because when you're on Twitter, you can also follow us, and I'm @Citanium.
Oh, okay.
Which is also a garbage word.
No, it's not. It's from Psychonauts. It's a thing.
It's a thing. He wrote it. It's on the internet. It must be real.
It's true. It's very true. You can also follow me. I'm @EXPLimited, and our show is @DelvePodcast.
Not nonsense words. Those actually mean something.
Those are word things. Yeah, those are abbreviations.
Those are real.
They are powerful words.
They are powerful words. They're not necessarily wish, but they're powerful words.
You can use those words to fight a terrorist. You'll fail, but you can use them.
Alex, if they wanted to find out more information about Delve, if they wanted to wish their way to more Delve content, where could they go online?
You can go to delvecast.com.
Perfect. And make sure to click on our Patreon banner and check out our Patreon content for, you know, the rough cut interviews and all of that good stuff over there. Make sure to follow us on iTunes, Google Play, and basically if there's a podcast app, we're on it. Spotify, iHeartRadio, every place where podcasts exist, we exist. Even in markets I didn't know were real. I keep getting notifications that one of our podcasts is on Hubhopper in Asia, and I didn't even know it existed, and it's apparently one of the biggest things in the world. Awesome. So
do they have analytics, though?
No, I don't think so. if only somebody had analytics, that would be good. But make sure you check us out all of those places. I like stars. That's how you do a wish for me. You give me all the stars. Again, I want to thank Alan Patrick for being on. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Alex, you're all set to be on an adventure now.
Yeah, I need to try and get not sleep time.
well, that's a different spell, Alex.
I need to stop sleeping during daytime hours and be able to like actually play a game now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good. Then you can go on an adventure too.
It would be great if I only had time.
Well, you know, I hear that time travel's making a comeback. We could make this work for you.
Perfect.
Anywho, the time traveling sleepy people over here are going to go away. Thank you all for joining us here on Delve. We will see you on the next one. Bye, everybody.
Bye.